Welcome to the Colour Time Podcast. I am your host, Vincent Taylor. This is the podcast where we speak to professionals who work with colour. Today, I am speaking to CEO and General Manager Bram Desmet of Flanders Scientific. Flanders make incredible colour accurate monitors for colourists, editors and the like. I've been wanting to speak to Bram for a very long time, so this should be good. Let's go.
Take your seats because the hourglass is about to turn. We are entering the world of the Micro Podcast. Explore the craft, creativity, and science of professionals who use color to tell stories. Welcome to The Color Timer with Vincent Taylor.
Bram, thank you so much for joining me, man.
Absolutely, it's such a pleasure to be here.
Oh no, it's great to finally meet you. And let's go. Oh, and I've got my reminder note.
There you go.
So I'm gonna start the game show. So here we go. Everything's in place. You are the CEO, General Manager at Flanders Scientific. And yep. Most people who are watching this or listening to this kind of know about Flanders. But for those who don't, can you tell me about the company? And I'm really curious to know where the name Flanders Scientific comes from.
Yeah, sure. So our kind of focus is really color accurate monitoring for post-production professionals, people in production environments who need color accurate monitors, and broadcast environments, things like that. But that's really it. Like, we cater to a really niche market. And as for the name, so all the founders of the company, myself included, were born in the Flanders region of Belgium. I've been here in the U.S. since I was 4 years old. So, but it's called, kind of in homage to the homeland that we name it. Flanders. And there's actually a super long, funny story behind it. Don't have time for it on this podcast, but if anybody ever wants to hear the whole tale behind the Flanders Scientific name.
Come on. Can you give us the reader's digest? I want to hear it. Have you got time? Is it really long?
I'll try to give you the short version. Right. So my dad was an old Barco guy. That's how we ended up in the U.S. So he was one of the first three employees for Barco's CRT division in the U.S., and when we were living in New Hampshire, when I was a little kid, him and some of his Barco colleagues decided that they were going to have a side project where they made a motion detecting Christmas ornament that when you walked by it would start playing jingle bells. And they were going to call the product the Jingle Ball. And the working name of the company, if they were going to start it and leave Barco, was Flanders, because they were all from the region, and yep. Scientific, just because it sounded cool. And one day their boss came in and said, hey, you have to decide if you're going to do this jingle ball crap or if you're going to actually keep working at Barco. So they gave up on it. But the joke in the household growing up is always, hey, if we ever start like a family business or anything, we're going to call it Flanders Scientific. And one of these days we're going to re-release the jingle ball. It was way ahead of its time, would have been way too expensive. But anyway, that's kind of the short version.
I'm sorry.
Of it.
I am so glad. That's awesome. I'm so glad you told that story. I was trying to do my due diligence and do a little bit of research, and I went, this man has been interviewed a lot, you know, and I went, well, yeah, and for good reason. But I'm curious, and it's, the answer can be no, but is there a question you wish that one of those people would have asked you, or something that you would have liked to have been asked about?
Yeah, so kind of on a geeky level, I probably would have wanted someone to ask me what my favorite class in college was, which was actually symbolic logic of all things. So, but yeah, that's the one thing no one's asked.
That's
me.
A subject. Again, with the risk of going over time, what the heck is symbolic logic? What is that?
So I was in a philosophy program. That was what I went to school for. And symbolic logic, because I want to take as few math classes as possible, symbolic logic counted as a math credit for philosophy students. So I took that instead. And essentially, it's like you through, as the name implies, symbols, you break down arguments and you essentially kind of sketch out argument, and you can tell whether an argument is valid just from, you know, kind of this if-then type scenario and premises, mm-hmm. right? So you can say, hey, even if all these premises are true, does the argument even make sense? And I loved it because it's like the gateway drug to like computer programming and that sort of logic, because it's very much the same sort of stuff. So it was cool because while I was in that philosophy program, I was always kind of a tech geek. I mean, growing up with a dad who worked for Barco and being into electronics and computers and those sorts of things, like I always kind of secretly had a passion for that stuff. So this kind of play to that was still kind of playing into my philosophy degree. So that's why I loved it.
That is so cool. And now you mentioned philosophy, and I saw that you studied philosophy. So I'm really curious what drew you to philosophy, number one, and I'm interested as to how that bleeds into what you do now, because I'm sure it does.
Yeah, to some degree. So the philosophy thing was really probably because I just love to argue and debate with people in high school. I fell in love with philosophy because for my kind of, exuberant young adult mind, like I thought if I understood things well and understood how to argue well and understood, you know, logic and ethics and those sorts of things, that I could actually change people's minds with that bedrock of knowledge. And so yeah. I went into a philosophy program just because I had love for it. And, you know, our parents were supportive to that respect, to say, hey, you know, do what you love. And that's I had dreams of being a philosophy professor. So yeah, so I got into it for those reasons and got disabused of that notion about halfway through college. So
it's interesting because you kind of answer my question then as well. My other question I was going to ask, which, you know, if you study teaching, you become a teacher. If you study engineering, you become an engineer. If you study a philosophy,
you want to become a philosopher, right? Which isn't like really a job title these days, typically. So, no, I want to be a philosophy professor. But the thing that was kind of a disconnect for me is when I was in college, like I was really interested in, like, for lack of a better term, applied philosophy. Like I wanted philosophy as it applied to the real world. And I just felt like academia in general, most of the professors I had were just so disconnected from the day-to-day reality. And it was just all this like esoteric theoretical stuff. And that wasn't really what I was into. So I saw it through, I still love it. It was kind of became a hobby instead of something I want to do for a job. And I took a circuitous route to this business because I actually, after college, went to flight school, got my private pilot's license, my instrument rating. So I thought I was going to be a pilot. So philosopher pilot was what was the career trajectory. I got sucked into this industry because while I was in flight school, my dad started his own company distributing broadcast equipment and said, hey, do you want to come help me? Because I was working at a bicycle store at the time. And he said, do you want to come help me? And I said, sure. And
how old were you then?
That was in my early 20s. That I started doing that. So I was in flight school probably when I was 22, 23 years old, and then started working for him part time, helping him with the website and that sort of stuff. And I mean, the thing is, I've always been kind of techie and into that tech stuff, and it just sucked me in. I mean, my first demo way before Flanders and any of that was I joined my dad when I was probably 14 years old or so at the time. When Home and Garden Television was starting up, and I went with him on that business trip and had lunch with the guys who were starting Home and Garden Television. So even at 14 years old, like I was kind of exposed to this stuff. I was aware of display technology. So, and then I just got sucked in. I mean, it became a passion. I learned on the job and I don't know. I mean, philosophy is kind of, you know, the symbolic logic stuff, especially like it plays into this industry to some degree. I do like to look at things from a scientific or logical sort of way. So maybe philosophy plays into that. But yeah, it's a circuitous route, but I love the business and became a total display geek. Yeah.
What was the impetus? And it sounds like it was a bunch of things, but, you know, where did you get the audacity to go, I'm going to start doing my own stuff. I'm going to start, you know, was it because the monitors that were out there were not meeting your level of expertise? What kind of drew you into that or pushed you into that?
I mean, like most good business moments, it was kind of a sink or swim moment for us, actually. So our company in the early days was a distribution company. So we sold various brands of other monitors. And then one of those distribution deals basically fell apart. It was what most of our business was. And we said, look, we want to find a joint venture partner. We found a good joint venture partner. And we kind of worked together to develop a new product, bring it to market, and do something that we were a lot closer to, had a lot more of a personal stake in. And yeah, a lot of people say, you know, it's kind of crazy. You're competing with all these giant companies. Yeah. But what was important for us is to try to bring value and color accuracy to the rest of the market. You know, there's the old saying, you don't get fired for buying Sony, right? But that doesn't necessarily mean that spending 35 grand is the best option for someone who's starting out on their own. So our bread and butter business for a long time was just, hey, here's a, you know, instead of a $10,000 monitor, here's a $5,000 monitor that's also color accurate, also gets the job done. And that's really been our continued focus. You know, we've definitely over the years, we've gone into doing hyper expensive stuff at times when it was the only way to do it. But we really try to focus more on the offering a lot of value and really focusing on the color accuracy aspect of it. And yeah, we had the audacity to do it just because we've been, you know, literally grew up around displays, display technology, selling other people's displays for a long time. And it's just, you know, was a passion, and we think we understand it really well. And I think that was the impetus for doing what we did.
How long has Flanders been going, and are you guys global? Are you selling worldwide?
Yeah, we're global. So we started the business in late 2000. So our first business was 2005. The Flanders brand name kind of came around in late 2008. We started shipping product in 2009. So we have been in business for a fair amount of time. We basically have four locations around the globe. So importantly, we have our joint venture partner who's located in Shenzhen, China. This is Zhengzheng Digital Video Co. So that's where everything's manufactured. That's where, you know, design, research and development, all that sorts of stuff happens there. And then we have the office in the UK for the UK market. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Brexit. That's why we have an office. Then we have an office in Belgium that serves the European market. And then our global headquarters is in Atlanta, Georgia. But yeah, we service all markets, U.S., UK, Europe are definitely our biggest markets, but we sell to customers in New Zealand and Australia and Singapore, and in our partners in China sell a lot of displays in mainland China as well. So we are about as global as a monitor company gets these days, but you know, we're also not a juggernaut like some of the big, you know, brands that also do cameras and switchers and all these other things.
Yeah. But before we started the recording, I said to you that many years ago, like a decade ago, when I was in Australia and I was setting up as a freelancer, sure, you know, I was looking at Flanders, and at that stage, there wasn't any in Australia, at least as far as I know.
Yeah.
And I was at that stage, I was going, oh, I don't know, it's a long way away, and how will I get the support? So
sure.
So how does that work now for if, you know, someone's in another part of the world and they need support?
Yeah, so we have some really good partners. So part of the impetus for like opening an office in Europe and in the UK was to offer more support in markets where we do a lot of volume. In markets like Australia, we have good local partners that help us a lot. So we've particularly worked with Mojo in Australia, and they do a great job for us. And Stuart really knows what he's doing over there. So that's how we kind of tackle that. It's also become a lot easier to ship things globally. You know, it honestly doesn't cost that much more to ship a monitor to Sydney compared to shipping an express service from Atlanta to LA. It's kind of crazy how small the world's gotten in a sense. So.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the website, there's a lot of monitors that you guys sell.
Yeah.
What, this is potentially a dumb question, but why are there so many? That's part one of the question. Why are there so many? And then who are your customers? Are they colorists, editors? Who's buying them?
Yeah. So DITs for production environments are our biggest customers. Then for post, it's editors and colorists. And then broadcast, you know, engineers who are buying our stuff. And yeah, we sell different monitors to kind of meet different needs. You know, sometimes people just need a basic monitor for editorial, and they just need something color accurate. They don't need it to have tons of wow factor. It just needs to be right. And so we make basic HD monitors for that. And then for people who need HDR mastering, we offer, you know, 2000 nit capable quantum dot OLEDs, right? So we offer, try to offer a spectrum to meet different needs at different budgets. Not everybody needs a $20,000 monitor. That's kind of been the whole premise of our business from day one. So we try to offer all different options.
Obviously, the color accuracy keeps coming up in our conversation. I know this is going to seem obvious to so many people, but why is that so important?
Well, so I always say, you know, people a lot of times say, hey, it doesn't matter because TVs are all over the place at home. But the reason it matters is because you want to be at the same neutral starting position as everybody else, right? Because yes, grandma's TV may be really green compared to a normal reference monitor or whatever. But if your content is way more red because you've been compensating on an incorrect monitor, that will still be noticeable even by just the general user and general observer. So we all want to start at the same neutral position because you don't want your content to be the outlier for the wrong reasons because you've graded it on an inaccurate display.
That makes total sense. Calibration. The world of calibration, you know, we get this beautiful Flanders Scientific monitor that we adore, and I've got many mates who have them who just love them. How do we maintain that so we know that it remains color accurate?
Yeah, so we spent a lot of time on that. So the main thing is that we do work with applications like Calman and ColorSpace if people want to use those. But over the last 2 years, especially, we spent a ton of time on something called Gaia Color AutoCal. It allows you to plug a probe directly into the monitor. It does a volumetric profile of the monitor in its uncalibrated state. It saves that to the display. And then any selections you make from the menu, gamut, EOTF, color temperature, it calculates lookup tables on the fly to target that space and get you there accurately. And the whole idea is you don't have to break out a computer. You don't have to be an expert. The only thing you need to do is be able to point the probe and set it up to match the crosshair we put on screen for you. We take care of everything else. So that's been a huge project for us, but we thought it was really important because if you want people to calibrate and keep their monitors calibrated, you have to make it easy. And that's been kind of the passion of ours for the last 2 years, working on that project and getting our AutoCal system out there to more users.
And the probe that you're talking about, is that a particular type of probe or?
So we integrate with a ton of different probes. It depends a bit on the monitor. Some monitors need probes that can measure a lot brighter, and some probes can't get up to those levels. Some monitors also have really good dark levels and you want something that can measure dark really well. So it depends, compatibility depends. But to give you an idea, the basic probes that work with this start at just $280. So for $280, wow, you can get a probe that works with the majority of the monitors. And then we support everything up to, you know, we have, you know, integration with a $16,000 Spectro if you own one of those from CRI, CR300, you can plug that in. So there's a wide range of probes. Our favorite is the CR100. It's a $5,500 probe. But again, $280 option works really well. And we have probably more of those out there than any other of the probes for this AutoCal process.
I think people who watch or listen to this podcast always go, Vincent, why does he even bother with the sand timer? Because it always goes over time, and the sand timer's finished. But I know, and it kind of gets to the end. I go, can I squeeze one more in? But I've got two more questions. If you don't mind, I want to just throw at you. Okay.
Ahead.
So you guys have another product called Box.io. What is that?
Sure. So Box.io is a color management device. Essentially, it's a LUT box, but it's a really powerful LUT box that allows you to do real-time LUT updates. So people sometimes will use them in post environments, but more often than not, they're used by DIT. So we have thousands of these out in the market. And what happens is people use this on a DIT cart with an application like Pomfort's LiveGrade. And basically what it is for establishing looks on set. And so you don't use an IO card, but rather the camera feed goes directly into this box and then back out the box. And you're using this to do basic, you know, CDL controls, different LUT manipulations. And every control adjustment you make is a new LUT that's sent to this LUT device. And then once you get a kind of pre-viz that everybody's happy with, you save that LUT. That LUT gets sent off to post as a starting point for, you know, hey, this is what the director intended the content to look like. So this device enables that. It's probably one of the most popular LUT boxes used by DITs. It is very much a niche product, even more so than monitors are. But it's powerful and kind of the de facto standard. standard in our industry for LUT boxes. So we took our expertise from the monitor side and basically put that in a box without a screen.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, last one I'll just throw at you, which is a beautiful broad question, but where do you kind of see, you know, because technology is just changing so fast, but where do you see Flanders, you know, 5 to 10 years' time?
So I'm still relatively young, I guess. So I'm hoping to just basically keep doing kind of what we've been doing. And I think the two things that I always try to be mindful of is that what we've seen is competitors kind of come and go in our industry over the years. And there's one or two mistakes that happen, right? They either fail to adapt or they try to shoot for the stars and overdo it and spend too much money on crazy science experiment projects where, you know, they forget that at the end of the day, they still have to sell something and make something that's interesting to the market at a reasonable price. Yeah. So we're going to continue to try to do color accurate displays that cater specifically to our market and try to ride that kind of balance of, you know, cost versus performance to get the majority of the market the thing that they need. So we're not necessarily always going to have the, you know, most expensive monitor on the market. We're also not going to be the least expensive monitor on the market. We really try to cover that middle ground that does the job for a majority of people. So our continued focus is just keep doing that, keep doing a good job of that, keep supporting our customers. And I don't really have any grandiose plans beyond that. I'm quite happy doing what I'm doing and talking to the people that I'm talking to and just keep chugging along doing what we've always been doing.
You don't want to develop a little Christmas ornament or...
You know, I mean, that's the retirement plan, right? So yeah. When I need to retire, we'll bring the jingle ball back
out. Dust off
those
plans. Yeah, yeah. Bram, it's a delight. It's great to finally speak to you, and thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Absolute pleasure, Vincent. Thank you so much.
Cheers, mate. Bram, thank you so much for being on the Color Timer podcast. I really appreciate it. Great to finally meet you and chat to you. I don't know, man. I think you should really develop the Christmas ornament idea. I think it'll go far. It'll sell. Thank you, everybody, for listening, watching. Like, subscribe, do all that kind of stuff, because I know I keep saying that, but it does really, really help. Keep the comments coming. Thank you to my executive producer, MixingLight.com. If you don't know what they do, check them out, MixingLight.com, everything color. Chances are you're watching this on their website, so you already know, but look, a great asset, really worth checking out. And that's it. I'll see you next time. Thanks a lot.
The Color Timer, a micro podcast experience.